So like time of feeding, as an example, is really important. And likely the day versus night rhythms that we see in microbes are really driven in part by substrate availability. And so from our original work, we actually noted that there were diurnal rhythms in short chain fatty acid production. So butyrate, as an example.
Welcome to the Science, Microbes and Health podcast from the International Scientific Association for Probiotics and Prebiotics. We're a non-profit scientific organization, also known as ISAP. I'm Marla Cunningham, ISAP's Executive Director. In our podcast, you'll hear about emerging topics across the fields of biotic substances and microbiome science. I hope you enjoy this episode with your host from the ISAP Board of Directors, Dr. Gabrielle Vinderola.
Hello and welcome everyone to this new episode of this series of podcasts from ISAP, Science, Microbes and Health. This time I'm very honored to have the pleasure, the presence of Vanessa Leone. Vanessa, she's an assistant professor in the Department of Animal and Dairy Science at University of Wisconsin Madison. There she obtained her PhD, then she did postdoctoral study and was instructor of medicine at the University of Chicago in the section of gastroenterology, pathology and nutrition. And presently, she's working in this day versus night oscillation in the pattern of microbes that we host and how that can impact on the metabolic health. So, Vanessa, thank you for joining us. It's really a pleasure. Okay, tell us a little bit, what is your work and what is your background and how we end up here?
Yeah, well, first of all, thanks so much for having me today. It's a real pleasure to speak with you. Yeah, I mean, I think it's been an interesting path to get to this line of investigation and a very serendipitous path at that. So when I first started my postdoc at University of Chicago, I was kind of charged with a project that was just coming online, thinking about how gut microbes might actually impact the host circadian system. And in that context, we had made an interesting finding using notobiotic and germ-free animals that the presence of gut microbes actually seemed to be very important for driving the circadian system in peripheral tissues like the liver. So that started this whole line of investigation of how do microbes then contribute to the host circadian system and the day versus night oscillations of, you know, host outputs of the circadian system relative to the gut microbiota. So that's kind of how we landed on this. And it's just opened up some really interesting questions and lines of investigation that kind of fit into this idea of, you know, how might we leverage the circadian system and an understanding of it to think about probiotics and prebiotics and how that might help to restore balance of the gut microbiome.
Great. In general, we hear that our microbe is quite variable. It will change with diet, with antibiotics. But how fast they change between day and night? How big are those changes, or which are the main genera or the metabolites? What are the changes that you can see from day to night?
Yeah, that's a great question, because I will say it's not an overt change that occurs over a 24-hour period where we have a completely new microbial community in the day versus the night. But from an abundance perspective, we do see that there's minor changes and, you know, maybe even medium changes that are occurring during the day versus the night in who's there, right? So the types of microbes that you would find. And this has been done by 16S sequencing as well as shotgun metagenomic sequencing. But what I think is even more important is not just who's there during the day versus the night, but what they're doing. And so we know, yeah, exactly. So like time of feeding, as an example, is really important. And likely the day versus night rhythms that we see in microbes are really driven in part by substrate availability. And so from our original work, we actually noted that there were diurnal rhythms in short chain fatty acid production. So butyrate, as an example. In our hands, we saw that in mice anyways, who are nocturnal animals, so eating only during the dark cycle, that their peaks in short chain fatty acids were shortly after the lights went on. So presumably right after they were done feeding, right, for that 24-hour period. And that was changed by the types of diet that we fed. So if we fed a high fat diet that was low in fiber, so not providing those microbes with the types of substrates that would be needed for making short chain fatty acids, we saw a loss in oscillations in those short chain fatty acids, as well as lower abundance overall. So I think what you say is like really important is for sure, we do see some changes over a 24-hour period as to who is there. But more importantly, we see changes in functional outputs of those microbiota over a 24-hour period that are in part tied to the feeding patterns of the host that's harboring them.
And what would you say would be the main diseases that are impacted by this night to day shift? What would be the metabolic diseases that you are targeting or you consider is that more affected than others?
Yeah, that's also a really good question. So in our hands, we are very interested in obesity. So thinking about metabolic dysfunction and obesogenic diets, high fat, low fiber, simple sugar or simple carbohydrate diets that would then lead to the development of obesity. I think the question that we had and still do have to some degree is kind of what comes first? Is it obesity that develops first and then we see a loss of rhythms of microbiota? Or is it loss of rhythms of microbiota that then is kind of like contributing then to these obesogenic patterns on the host side? I think a really interesting study that came out of Dirk Holler's group was they actually had single sample collections from a number of individuals. It was a very large cohort of individuals. They were specifically interested in diabetes. And so what they saw was that in diabetics, with this large cohort data set, even just a single time point from each individual, that there are about 13 operational taxonomic units or OTUs that lost rhythms in diabetic individuals. And importantly, that seemed to kind of be able to predict from a pre-diabetic perspective who might go on to then develop diabetes. So I think that there's obviously a very much important back and forth that's happening between the microbiota. But a loss of rhythmicity might actually help us to predict the onset of metabolic diseases like obesity, type 2 diabetes, maybe even metabolic dysfunction associated steatotic liver disease, which recently got renamed from non-alcoholic fatty liver disease. So those are kind of the diseases that we are considering specifically in the context of rhythmicity of gut microbiota.
And do you think that people that work at night, they are more prone to develop chronic diseases? Is there something that, because many people work at night or they live at night, do you think those people are more prone to develop some chronic disease, metabolic disease?
Yeah, and I think there's some really important features to that. So if we have individuals who are chronically working a third shift job, let's say, they tend to have less development of some of these chronic metabolic diseases. So it's that consistency of chronically working third shift. But where we get into a lot of trouble is individuals who are constantly shifting back from day shift to night shift. So nurses, you know, our police force, our firefighters. So those individuals who are constantly shifting back and forth tend to have, you know, more risk, higher risk for metabolic diseases and even other diseases that are associated with metabolic diseases like cancer as well. So for sure, the day versus night patterns, even those who experience jet lag frequently, right? So COVID kind of helped us out from that regard because we have people who are not traveling quite as much. But for those who are constantly, you know, traveling and crossing, you know, many time zones, that can also be a factor for the development of metabolic diseases as well.
And do you think, is it too early to make any recommendation in relation to their food? Do you think they have to get their food before starting the shift when they go to bed? Is there, or is it too early to say something like that?
Well, I think that there is some research out there to kind of show that trying our best to keep in alignment even when we are traveling is really important. So continuing to stay fasted when you might expect to be fasted while you're making that transition. So some of my colleagues who are deeper in this space of understanding just the circadian pacemaker in general would say that for every hour that you travel, it takes about a day, right, to kind of catch up. So if you can kind of keep your eating behavior more similar to what you were doing before you started travel and then gradually try to align if you're going to be there for a long period of time, that might be a good strategy to consider. And I know Sachin Panda at the SOC, he has done some really great work trying to understand some of these effects that occur when we have jet lag or are experiencing jet lag as well. So yeah, I don't think, because everybody's chronotype is so different, that's often when I lecture on circadian rhythms in the context of the host or the microbes, I always pull the class, like who in the class is an owl versus a lark, right? Because we all have differences in our chronotype. So those who rise early and those who stay up very late. And I think that's very individualized in kind of our thinking as well. And our circadian systems change as we age as well. So we kind of start to shift to be earlier, right? I mean, we always talk about the early bird special and things like that. I mean, there really is some science behind that as well.
And in your research, you studied the influence of circadian rhythm, but also you have the diet in the middle. How can you distinguish between what is the contribution of the circadian rhythm and the contribution of the diet? Is there a possible way to say, okay, this is these changes are due to the diet, these changes are due to the circadian cycle? Is it possible?
Yeah, I think that's a good question. And I think how we set up our studies, especially if we're using animal model systems, can kind of help us to tease that apart. So there are some animal models where key genes of the circadian system are knocked out, right? So using our genetic manipulation and manipulating some of these genes has really been important from that perspective, because then we can have animals that are missing, let's say, a key activator of the circadian network that has large disruptions, even in a tissue-specific manner, and then have those animals on and off a high-fat diet, as an example, to kind of understand what is really driven by the circadian system as compared to what is then being contributed by the diet. And in some of the studies that we've done and that I collaborated with at University of Chicago, then we also had those animals under germ-free conditions as well. So then we were able to kind of probe what those systems looked like in the absence of gut microbiota on and off the high-fat diet, and then in the presence of the microbiota on and off that high-fat diet. And I think by kind of doing all of those groups, we get a sense then of how that pacemaker in the body is influencing the microbiota as compared to the diet itself. I think the other thing that we can do is we can do time-restricted feeding. So that work has been done by a good friend and colleague of mine, Amir Zarinpar, at UCSD, alongside Sachin Panda when he was still a trainee. And they showed that time-restricted feeding, the high-fat diet, prevents metabolic disturbances and also restores some of the oscillations of the gut microbiota. So even though those animals are still on the high-fat diet, they do have some recovery of the day versus night patterns of the gut microbiota, both from a who's there perspective as well as from a functional perspective. So I think we're able then to sort of tease out the importance of the host's pacemaker from the diet, from the microbiota as well.
And you came into a very, very interesting topic and something that creates a lot of polemics, that is fasting or restriction in the period of eating. Would you have any perspective how this can contribute? Is it okay to restrict our period of feeding? Should we eat less calories? Should we eat better food? Of course, we should eat better food. But is there any something that you can see of, okay, when to eat during the day? Exactly.
Yeah. So at least in humans, as diurnal animals, it is suggested that eating calories earlier in the day, it has more beneficial effects for glucose tolerance. And I think that also is impacted by the gut microbiota as well. So that's kind of some ongoing research that I'm sort of working on. I'm adjacent, I will say, to it, and just a collaborator on it. But, you know, trying to understand how early eating versus late eating might impact the metabolome, right, for the individual, and then how the gut microbiota might then, you know, be kind of a secondary contributor there too as well. So that is kind of the suggestion. And what the literature would suggest for now is that, you know, early eating would maybe have a more beneficial effect on metabolic outcomes versus late eating. But there are some situations that kind of bump up against that idea. So when we think of some of our European counterparts who might actually have multiple meals during the day and even like an early supper versus a dinner later, then I think that comes back to the types of foods that they're eating, right? That can then have kind of maybe even override that effect of like a late eating situation. So, I mean, I don't think there's a one size fits all approach, but having a solid understanding of, like I said, your chronotype and trying to shift your caloric intake a little earlier in the day is, I don't think, ever going to hurt anyone. And now those constant glucose monitors that become available for individuals might help us to better understand people's chronotype in regard to response to meal timing and glucose spikes throughout the day to better understand the time of day that they should be actually taking in meals. And we know that the gut microbiota can definitely fit right into that because they can impact things like GLP-1 and other gut hormones that feed directly into glucose tolerance. So I think that, you know, those things all together could be utilized and leveraged to think about restoring balance from a metabolic perspective.
Now you came across to a very, very interesting point that are glucose spike. Because I don't know how it's there, but in Argentina, a lot of discussion about if we should have glucose spike during the day, or it will depend if you are eating proteins or carbohydrates. What is your perspective in relation to glucose spike? How healthy it is? How can we manage them? Is it something that we should worry about? Because I see many people wearing those devices. And I see now, is it okay? Or are they getting like, you know, stressing, you know, trying to control every glucose spike along the day? What's your opinion?
Yeah, no, that's a really good question. And I shouldn't say that I'm an expert in glucose and diabetes. Like that is, so let me just say that first. But from my understanding of the literature and my colleagues who do work in this space, of course, a glucose spike is necessary. We need to have that after we eat. And I think that the insulin resistance phenotype and how long that glucose spike persists is probably even more important than that initial spike, right? So how quickly does it recover is, I think, a more important question because that tells us how insulin resistant an individual is and the contribution there. So to me, I think it's reasonable to want to understand like what foods, especially if we are in a pre-diabetic state, contribute to an elevated glucose response that does not return to baseline quickly, and how different foods can affect that is a worthwhile endeavor. And I do know that like if we think about eating later in the day and past a certain time, that glucose level doesn't always recover as compared to if we were eating earlier in the day. So that means that we have sustained glucose levels for longer, even when we're going to sleep, as an example, that could actually be detrimental for host health. So, and how microbes contribute to that, I think we don't fully have an understanding of that for sure. But, you know, maybe when we think about being able to kind of measure microbially derived metabolites in the periphery, maybe as we develop more sensors and things like that, we might have an understanding of how microbial contributions to the host metabolome aligns with glucose levels, as an example, to have a better understanding of how they're entwined with one another over time, specifically.
That's good. That was a great answer. Let me take you to a little bit different topic. You know, ISAP, the International Scientific Association of Probiotics and Prebiotics, and in this field of probiotics, there are a lot of discussion about when to take probiotics. Should we take probiotics during the day, at night? Is there any science that you can tell us about if there is any efficacy difference depending on the time where we take our probiotics?
Yeah, I think that's a really great question. And I think that's in part where my research is heading. And I mentioned Amir Zarinpar as an example. He has some really interesting data looking at a specific potential of the gut microbiota from a bile salt perspective. So he's looking at bile salt hydrolase, which we know that many of our probiotics, when we think about bifidobacteria and lactobacillus, many of them harbor a bile salt hydrolase gene. And that is directly then impacting secondary bile acid synthesis, which we know those secondary bile acids are so important, not only for lipid uptake and absorption, but also amazing signaling molecules throughout the body that I think we're just like chipping away at the surface. So, I mean, at least from Amir Zarinpar's work and thinking about bile salt hydrolase, definitely time of feeding and then dietary intake is really important for driving rhythms in secondary bile acid synthesis. So, you know, a lot of that work so far has been done in mice, so it's difficult to translate to humans to understand when we might want to have those probiotics present. So I don't have a solid answer for when we should exactly be taking in these probiotics, but I do think that time of day matters because not only are we thinking about that probiotic, but then the other microbial community members that might be interacting with it, as well as various host factors that might be present that either enable that microbe to elicit its beneficial effect or that actually inhibit it, right, from actually doing what we think it should be doing. So I think we kind of have to explore that a little bit more. And, you know, there is some science out there that says, oh, you know, if you take it during the day, it offers a more beneficial effect due to changes in acidity and how that microbe is making it through the stomach, as an example, taking it with meals. But I think also not just from a probiotic perspective, but a prebiotic perspective too. So what do we need to have at the same time of day or from a meal timing perspective for that bug to have its most beneficial effect on the host? So I think those are the types of studies that I would like to see. And I think if others are who are in the probiotic space who are listening to this, if they're doing some of these trials, understanding when individuals are taking in these probiotics and actually recording that as a factor alongside some of the other, you know, outcomes that they're measuring would be really beneficial for the field to kind of understand and maybe be able to make some recommendations going forward. So maybe that's a little too circular of an answer, but I think hopefully, you know,
I think it's a very, very nice answer because I see many, many people talking about probiotics and stating that you should get the probiotics in the morning or at night, but without any evidence. So maybe it's better to say, okay, we don't know that stating things that they don't have any science behind.
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's not something that we've thought of, right? I think that's another key thing that we discussed. So I was a co-author on a paper that was published earlier this year, driven by Amir Zarinpar as the corresponding author. And that was one of the key points that we were trying to make in the paper was that, you know, time of sample collection is so crucial to understand, even from, you know, when we're thinking about stool collection or even oral swabs. And that should be considered so that we can maybe make some more statements about why we see so much variability from study to study. So not only is it because there's just high heterogeneity across individuals, but also the time of day of sampling is so crucial. And if we don't capture that as a variable, then we lose that resolution, right, that we otherwise might have. So, yeah, I think it's an important consideration to have.
Most of the study you did so far were in mice, right? Or also people, how do you manage that timing of sampling? Because not everybody goes to the washroom at the same time or when you want to get the sample. How do you, and see, that's very important for your research, the exact timing of sampling. How do you manage that?
Yeah, that's a great question. So my lab is basically in the lab 24 hours a day. When we are doing studies where we are trying to understand the implications for the circadian system and that, you know, direct interaction between microbes and the circadian system, we often will collect samples over a 48-hour period. So we're collecting every 4 to 6 hours from the same animal over a 48-hour period. So that's one way under, you know, a 12-12 light-dark cycle, as an example. We also collect other samples the same way over a 24-hour period, maybe every 4 hours. So yeah, those are things that we consider. Now, other studies that we don't necessarily or aren't necessarily relating to the circadian system, we will ensure that we collect samples from the mice at the same time of day. So I think that that is a really important then consideration. So I always tell new students in the lab, if you decide you're going to collect in the morning, then you have to routinely collect in the morning. There's no deviation from that.
By yourself.
Exactly.
Do you know, presently there is a lot of interest in this microbiome testing. And there are, you can send your sample, they send you a sampling material, then you get the sample back. Do you think that in the future, and we know that it's quite in infancy, it's not still robust, the evidence to say, okay, if you have this microbiome, you should eat this and this and this. Do you think that in the future, you can have your microbiome tested and they can tell you, okay, you should eat early in the morning, at midnight? What do you think this can take us in the future, your research?
Yeah, I think that's a really great question. And I agree with you. I think some of the microbiome tests that are out there are not really vetted from a scientific perspective, right? They're still pie in the sky thinking. But I think that there are some groups working in incorporating metabolomic readouts that I think could be really impacting, right? So understanding what those microbes are doing can be more important even than understanding who's there, as we kind of, you know, started our discussion talking about. So I think as we kind of move toward that, where we can actually kind of meld together this the next-gen sequencing approaches as we move into third and fourth generation iterations of these with metabolomics-based approaches, then I think we might be able to make some inferences there. But from a circadian perspective, I think we still need to understand a little bit better the chronotype of that host or individual that's providing that sample. So either getting actigraphy data from them, right, to understand just their basic day versus night behaviors. Having time-stamped samples is really crucial, right? Collecting that data for what does come in for us to use our tests on. I think those are really key features that will be important for maybe making inferences going forward, as well as I think from the capacity to ask scientific questions and have controlled trials is really important in humans too. So, you know, we're working with a group, for instance, at University of Chicago, who often does 24-hour samplings from individuals who are brought into the clinic. So we know it's challenging to collect microbiome samples, right, over a 24-hour period, especially from humans. We're lucky if, you know, individuals go once a day. So then what can we rely on? I think that's where the metabolome and having an understanding of microbial contributions to the metabolome can be really beneficial, because we can get things like urine over a 24-hour period. We can get blood over a 24-hour period, especially from people who are in clinical setting, and being able to kind of understand that alongside some of these larger studies where we're only able to grab one sample from each individual. So kind of having that controlled situation to correlate with the larger population-based studies. So I think that's kind of where I see this going, but having that understanding then of when samples are collected and the chronotype of the individual is really important.
We are coming close to the end, but before we say goodbye, I would like to ask you a question, because we, in general, we speak about these circadian cycles in 12 hours of light and 12 hours of darkness. But let's imagine people living in the northern pole, in the southern pole, that they don't see the sun for 2 months. Do you have any opinion on what's happened to their microbiomes, or do you have any plan of studying their microbiome? Because they don't have any.
No, I think that's a really great point. And they're in what we call constant conditions, right? So we can put mice in constant conditions. We can put them in constant dark or constant light. And there actually was a more recent paper that came out. Also, I think it was Sandra Kiesling, and if I'm mispronouncing the name, I apologize, and Dirk Haller's group, where they actually had mice that had the clock knocked out or deleted only from the intestine. Okay. Putting them in constant dark or constant light conditions. And sure enough, there's some day versus night patterns that persist even in those constant conditions. So they're not just tied to the light dark cycle. They're actually tied to that endogenous circadian cycle. You know,
there's something else. Yeah. Not only the light. There is something else that.
Yeah. And I think that's what we would see in humans too. I think that we'll find that there is a proportion of the microbiota that is inherently oscillatory. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, Vanessa, I think it was a great talk. Just let us know, what do you think yourself and your research in 5 years, in 10 years? What are the questions that you are trying to answer in the next decade?
Yeah, that's great. Thanks for asking that. So one thing that I've become really interested in is understanding how rhythms in the gut microbiota actually develop, and how that contributes then to the host circadian and metabolism networks as an individual goes from infancy all the way into adulthood. So we have done some studies in germ-free mice to show that when we colonize them late in life, we don't recover every aspect of the circadian system, and we want to know why. So, you know, are microbes really important for driving an imprinting effect on the host circadian network in general? So those are some of the questions that we ask, and I think we can think about that from a probiotic perspective as well. So like breastfed infants versus formula-fed infants, which again, I think Dirk Haller's group has done some really interesting research in that area just recently. to understand how rhythms in the microbiota develop and how that feeds back onto the host circadian network. I think that's really important when we think about premature infants as an example. So we know that when an infant is born premature, they're obviously kind of gaining a microbiome earlier than anticipated in some instances. And oftentimes they will be on parenteral feeding, so only nutrients infused peripherally. And that occurs over a 24-hour period. So they're constantly being infused with nutrients. Is that really how babies should be fed? Even if they're premature, we don't know, right? And then how does that change the development of their microbiome and the host circadian network? And does that then predispose them to develop conditions later in life, whether it be immunological or metabolic disruption? So hopefully in 5 years, I'll have somewhat of an answer from a research and, you know, a preclinical model situation that we might then be able to make some inferences or translational inferences to the clinic. So, yeah, that's what I hope to be doing.
I think you're preparing very, very important answers, and I think people will be really expected that. Where can people find, where can people follow you with your results? Are you in social media? Does your lab have a webpage, something that people can keep track of your research?
Sure. So I have my university webpage. I have a Twitter or whatever X account. I don't use it very often. I will say I'm not very good at the social media. I'm a little bit of a hermit when it comes to that. Something I need to be better about. But yeah, and people are always more than welcome to reach out to me via email. Yeah, I kind of always struggle, like I know a lot of scientists do, about tooting our horn for all the work that we're doing.
But we can find you in PubMed for sure, and your works. Vanessa, it was such a pleasure. We learned a lot. This is a topic that we don't discuss much, so it was a great contribution, and thank you for joining this podcast.
Yeah, and thank you again so much for having me. I really enjoyed our conversation for sure.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Science, Microbes and Health podcast from ISAP. Check the show notes for links and further information on this topic. You can also send us your feedback, questions or topic suggestions by emailing info@isapscience.org. Don't forget to follow or subscribe to this podcast so you never miss a new episode.